is a lot on your head. So that will be the start of sanity. Well, we might start this vital issues seminar anyway, despite the fact that the bells are going and it is a very busy parliamentary day, so I know a number of people who would have liked to have been here today probably won't be able to be here today, but the good thing is the audio of today's program will be available later today, and the slides will be available in a PDF in the next day or two, so that everyone who isn't here will still have access to the information. I'll just start off by saying I'm Roxanne Missingham, I'm the Parliamentary Librarian, and welcome to the very first Vital Issues Seminar for 2011. It's a very busy parliamentary calendar, so we've been trying to look at issues that are incredibly relevant, and for us this year is one in which issues of climatic variability are high on the radar. We've had floods, bushfires and the end of long-term drought in many states in January. The earthquakes in New Zealand and Japan have reminded us of the fragility of the environment on which we stand. And for the Australian Parliament, climate change is a fundamental issue for many inquiries and discussions. If you look at the committee's current inquiries page, there are 8 inquiries happening in Parliament at the moment for which climate is an important consideration, not including about 8 bills inquiries into climate-related bills before the Parliament. Some of the reports and inquiries are bushfires across Australia, management of the Murray-Darling Basin, and sustainable management by the Commonwealth of Water Resources. So the climate is very topical, and we are very fortunate to have an eminent speaker today. Speaker is an expert on climate from the Bureau of Meteorology, Dr. Carl Braganza. He heads the area responsible for collecting and analysing climate data in Australia and the region. The section provides climate information such as drought, bushfire and extreme events, seasonal prediction and regional climate change. Carl received a PhD from the School of Mathematics at Monash University, and his research work has centred on understanding the causes of climate change using computer modelling and instrumental observations and paleoclimatic evidence. He's worked in close cooperation with various national and international science groups such as CSIRO, Marine and Atmosphere, the UK Met Office, Hadley Centre and Geophysical Fluid Dynamics Laboratory, Princeton. His topic for today is Droughts and Flooding Rains, Australia's Climate Variability, and I'd like you to welcome Carl.
Yeah, the topic was chosen by, I think the subject title was chosen by Roger.
Yes, I admit that.
Generally, if you open with Dorothy McKellar at a climate meeting, there's lots of groans through the audience, but I was happy to go with it for today. The focus was on climate variability. It's a little difficult to talk about that without talking about climate change, so the two are quite intertwined in Australia. So I'm going to leap between the two, hopefully in a logical progression. So first, I'll set the scene, talking a little bit about Australia's natural climate variability, focusing on rainfall here, which is the one that it's the variable that Australia is most concerned with. Then the question that everyone's been asking us over the last 8 months, how significant has extreme weather been over 2010, 2011? Is it related to climate change or is this just natural variability? Specific focus, I'll come back to talk about the rainfall and La Nina. And then I'll finish off talking about some long-term shifts in Australia's climate, relating that back again to the variability that we're talking about. So my first slide here is a plot of Australian, or South Australia, so Southern Australia, rainfall anomalies, so that's departures from the long-term mean, in winter time. And the thing about this plot is if you show this to climate experts in the Northern Hemisphere, they'll generally think this came from a large farm or from a very small subsection off a continental area. To have this much rainfall variability and that sort of level of irregular rainfall on a continent is very unusual. It makes the job of detecting trends and actually working out what's going on with Australian rainfall quite difficult. And I've just got some images to emphasise sort of dust and deluge against different images of the built environment. So from early in the 20th century, cycling through to the 70s and 80s, so that's the 74 Brisbane flood on the right, that's the Melbourne dust storm of the El Nino event of 82-83, and then coming back to recent times, we had the Sydney dust storm of a couple of years ago, and that's the Brisbane flood from 2010. So that basically, the data well describes Australian climate variability, as does Dorothy McKellar's poem. It really is a land of droughts and flooding rains. So this is a complicated plot. I'm just going to go through it rather quickly. So to set up our understanding of what drives Australian rainfall variability, you need a little bit of an understanding of the things that influence our weather. The thing that is the biggest impactor on Australian weather is the tropical oceans in our vicinity. So variability in the temperature, particularly the sea surface temperature, is really the engine that drives rainfall variability over Australia. When it's warm in the ocean surrounding Australia, you tend to get more rainfall, and vice versa. The other major impact on our weather over the south is this mid-latitude weather system, so cold fronts and wintertime storms. That's a Mediterranean climate. Historically, the wintertime rainfall across the south has been pretty reliable over winter in comparison to tropical rainfall. Sometimes the monsoon fails, sometimes it doesn't. We have seen some trends in that wintertime rainfall. I'll speak a little bit about that. But really, just to emphasise, it's variability. So ENSO is this El Niño Southern Oscillation that the meteorologists talk about, this cycling between El Niño and La Niña. And its cohort is called the Indian Ocean Dipole in the Indian Ocean. And again, it's a similar physical mechanism in place there that drags rainfall over Australia. So, and just to set up what we're talking about when we're talking about this thing called ENSO, or El Niño Southern Oscillation, I don't have a pointer, so I'm just going to wander over here. I think you can hear me. So tropical convection is the thing that drives rainfall. So when you have a patch of really warm ocean temperature, that's basically a pump. It pumps this moisture up into the atmosphere, and that falls as rain. So it's really where that warm water sits that determines where the rainfall is in the tropical Pacific. And in a normal sort of neutral year, this is what it looks like. We have the trade winds pushing from east to west. They pile the warm water up to the north of Australia. That warm water sets off convection, and you tend to get good rainfall just across the north of Australia. During the La Niña event, this is intensified. So what you're getting is very much more warm water, more intense convection, and more rainfall over the whole of Australia. What happens during an El Niño, which is the opposite, the trade winds kind of fail, and the warm water tends to drift off into the eastern and central Pacific. It takes the rainfall with it, and that's when Australia experiences dry conditions. That's a very simple schematic. It's a very complex thing. It's one of the more difficult climate modelling problems, is understanding what will happen to ENSO under climate change, because it's such a complex coupled system between the atmosphere and the ocean. You need a very, very high resolution planetary model to look at this. But that's the basic story. That's what's really driving this rainfall variability, is this swinging around of the ocean temperatures. And so this is all Australian rainfall, which is a bit of a weird quantity. It doesn't actually mean much physically, but what you can do from that is pick out La Niña events very clearly. So again, these are departures from the long-term mean, and what you can see here is La Niña events around 1918, then we're going through to the early 50s and the mid-50s. That's that big event in the early 70s, so from about 71 through to 74. Then again in 98 and around 2000, and that was the latest one. And what you can see from this is that relative to these really intense periods of rainfall, the rest of the time it's really dry. And that's typically Australia's climate is actually below this line. It's those bursts of tropical rainfall over the whole continent that really break up what is a semi-arid or arid continent. And so much so that the El Niño events that we look at are actually hard to pick out from the record. And that's one, because we're using this measure. If I use a different measure, I can pick them out more clearly. But by this measure, really, the drought conditions are amid a background of very dry conditions. It's these very wet years that make the difference. In Australia, that is really important, because most of the yields from our crops are determined from these very, very wet periods. So 80% of the yield comes from less than 50% of the time, probably close to about 20% of the time for some regions. And the whole environmental ecosystem of Australia is set up for these wet periods with some regularity. If we change the return period between these, that has really big implications on agriculture, on catchments, and on ecosystems throughout Australia. So that's something you need to keep in mind as we go through this talk. And now what I'm going to do is just step through some maps off those La Niña events that I picked out. This is basically a scale of deciles, which is a rank, it's a percentile. So what you're looking at for those blue is the top 90 and 95th percent of events. And generally when we've got a La Niña event on, and the ones I've chosen almost always fit into that top 90th percentile. Don't worry about the scale, I guess use the words on that scale. So the highest on record years tend to always occur in a La Niña year. And as you can see, it's quite continentally consistent. When you get a really strong La Niña, and these are the ones we're talking about, you get good rainfall over the whole continent. Going through to the early 50s, we had this dipolar situation where the West Dry was dry. And it's really, that's just to emphasise that it's Eastern Australia, Queensland, New South Wales, Northern Territory that tends to feel La Niña more. Going through, so 54, there's some peak floods in the Murray-Darling Basin during the 50s. Still probably the high water marks along the Murray are from this time. Very intense rainfall for periods during these years. And the one that's close to most people's living memory, if you know, in planning and policy, is the 74 events. And you can see the intense rainfall along Brisbane there. It was closer to the coast and actually more intense than what we got in 2010. And then finally moving, so that's just the 73 to 76 period. That's still the wettest period that we've ever had on record since 1900 when we've been keeping records, and probably another 50 years beyond that from patching together other records. And then to put into context what we've had this year, very similar again, except for that very, very dry patch in the southwest. We actually believe that's a climate change component of the Australian rainfall, and I'll talk a little bit about that as we go on. But again, very consistent with previous La Niña events. And now looking at El Niño events and drought, and these are picking out the very strong ones. The thing about the El Niño is it's much more fluky than La Niña. We'd say it's non-linear in physical sciences, which means the relationship between La Niña and rainfall is much stronger than the relationship between El Niño and drought. It's just that we've had a lot of drought lately, so this is front and centre in people's consciousness. So that's the Federation drought, or the tail end of it. It began prior to 1900. Still one of the worst droughts on record. Large parts of Queensland, you know, related to the labour movement, this drought in some sociology texts. But again, Eastern Australia, that influence from El Niño dried out the continent for a number of years. The second major drought was the World War II drought, really focused on the central and lower Murray-Darling Basin. The Murray-Darling Basin sort of encapsulates an area like this. Again, this is very severe drought during those years. And then the current drought, or also known as the Big Dry, particularly in the Murray-Darling Basin, the last 10 years up until this year were very dry. Aspects of that were different to the previous droughts, and I'll talk a little bit about that as we go on. That's just episodic drought, and that's what most people understand. By episodic drought, I mean an absence of rainfall for years on end. That's not the way meteorologists always look at it. And I've got another slightly subtle period here, which is 1996 to 2009. We're still looking at lowest on record rainfall across southern Australia. That's periodic drought on top of a systematic decline in rainfall. And it's the systematic decline in rainfall that we're actually most concerned about in terms of going forward. So that's what I'll talk about a little bit as well, how that plays off against the natural variability. And you can see also, there's actually two trends going on here, so not just episodic drought. We've had an increased monsoon over the last few decades, and we've had this drying trend, just a reduction in rainfall during winter over southern parts, and I'll talk a little bit more about that. The next point of context, just sort of jumping out of this, when I talk about this extreme events, depending on the audience I talk to, there is a perception out there that we're still using extreme climate events to track and determine and prove climate change, that evidence of climate change depends on how we're tracking these extreme events. That's just totally not the case. Really, the evidence for climate change is fundamental, and these are the IPCC reviews. They're each a telephone book size, about that thick. They're just reviews of the scientific literature. The IPCC doesn't conduct any science, they just review the scientific literature. That, since 1990, has been rock solid, that what we've seen in the climate system is greenhouse related. So when we talk about these extreme events from the science perspective, it's more out of interest of what's the pace of global warming, how's it going along. And in fact, this statement that warming of the climate system is unequivocal and that most of the observed increase in global temperatures is likely due, or very likely due, to increased greenhouse gases, has pretty much nothing to do with the risk of doubling CO2. And that's a point that the public appreciates less than they should. The fundamental evidence against doubling atmospheric CO2 comes from fundamental physics and chemistry. It doesn't come from looking at the observations. An analogy to that is having a heavy smoker, testing them at age 25 for their health. They'd probably be okay, mostly. And then determining from that health check whether it was okay to continue to smoke it back a day. That's really what is out there in the public now. We're sort of monitoring these observations as if they inform the future risk. They don't at all. The future risk is informed from the paleo record and from climate modelling. If you double atmospheric CO2, you dramatically change the climate system. So that's fundamental. So that's just a bit of context to what I'm going to talk about next. And the way we track that is really through mean changes. We're not looking at those really extreme parts of the distribution. We're looking at statistically robust things. So things like that this clear trend in Australian mean temperatures. So there's parts of the climate record we look at to establish this. Again, this is just context to talk about these extreme events and natural variability. I'm going to break a few rules of communication and put up a normal distribution or a bell curve here. And that's really just to provide another point of context to understanding extreme events. Most people have some familiarity with a bell curve or a normal distribution. Typically, if you've just had a new baby and you're measuring head circumference, weight, you'll be given a distribution and your baby will fit in the 50th, 60th, whatever percentile of that. Most people get what that means. So the mean of a normal distribution, and this one I've just made up, it's idealised. We're looking at the height of children at age eight. The curve in purple describes all the heights that males can attain. And if it's normally distributed, or a bell curve, the average male height corresponds to the number of individuals up the y-axis that is the most common occurrence. So that is the mean or the average male. If I get a different population, and this time females, you'll find that's shifted. So there's more females at a greater height in this comparison than there is males. So the two distributions are different. Now, when I'm talking about extreme events, there's something very important to note, and everything to the left of this line occurs in both populations. Basically, what we've got is, in this region here, you've got a higher incidence of female than male height. So there's more females with that height. But if I just took one height out, and was asked which population did that come from, I have no way of determining that. So that's really important that it's the frequency of occurrence that we look at. It's not these single events. So the overlap in the measure of trait is there, but a greater incidence in females. It's really only out here, once you go beyond that dashed line, that if you were given a height, you could hazard a guess, oh, hang on, that's probably a female, just based on one sample. You still wouldn't be that confident of that. Swapping it through to another idealised example, we're going to talk about maximum temperature here. Two populations, this time I've got weather from 1955 and weather from 2005. And maximum temperature, I'm going to put in two lines where the distributions overlap. So if I take one sample out from that and I was asked, did that occur in 1955, 2005? I have no idea. I have no way of determining that. If I sample it enough and I look at the frequency, I might be able to separate those two out. Importantly, what we have measured is this shift in the mean. And that's the most statistically robust thing that we're talking about. We're not talking about shifts in extremes. That part of the distribution down there is potentially weather we don't see much anymore. This is what we're measuring. It's the same old warm weather that we had in 1955, but there's just much more of it. So if you're going to point to a really warm day and say, could this have occurred in the past? Of course it could have. But it's the frequency of occurrence, it's how often that occurs, that is the most critical thing. And that's much more boring than extreme events, but it's the bit that we measure. And this is the bit that grabs the news and that everyone's interested in. That's weather that's potentially outside our historical experience. But as you can see, the tail of this distribution keeps going. So you still cannot say the things that people want you to say, that this is definitely due to climate change. It's impossible in this. It's really that shift in the distribution. So that's the context. What does that look like in the data? Well, what I've plotted on top there is consecutive days above 20 in Melbourne. So the shorter that period, the more often cold weather occurs. And you can see there is a slight shift in time. And then when you get to the late 90s, it goes up to the point that we had a third of a year where it just did not drop below 20 in Melbourne. And that's quite an alarming statistic, actually. It means that there's probably a step change in the weather around this time. So that's what the data looks like. Another way is to track maximum temperature records in Australia. And what you find, again, is since the 80s, the number of sites that break their records has probably doubled compared to the previous part of the record. So that's what that shift in distribution looks like. It's not just in climate data, it's in phenology data, so when things are flowering, migration. It's also in the insurance data. What we've got here is events that, just a count of events, it's not necessarily tied to losses. Geological events are down here, earthquakes, that's been reasonably steady over time, as you'd expect. It's the weather and climate events that have increased. I think there's a lot in this data, but the guys from Munich Re are pretty confident that this is actually describing reality, that we're having more extreme events as time goes on. And these are extreme events, extreme heat events themselves that result in losses in the historical record. It's more of a problem than most people imagine, I think, in terms of the cost of the economy and lives and others. So another way of looking at that, and I'm just going to jump to Europe, where these things, they've got more power to study some of these extreme events than us. There's a lot of supercomputing that needs to be done for studying extreme events. And what I'm going to point to here is the black line there is observed European temperatures since late 1800s. The red line is output from a couple of climate models from Europe. And you can see it reasonably tracks the observations. Important to note that climate model has no observations in it. It just has greenhouse gases and other forcings, and otherwise it's the climate system. We don't tell it what the climate system's actually doing. So that's why we'll get peaks, but they aren't necessarily timed. It's just peaks that come out of the climate system. That black peak there is the 2003 European heatwave. It cost $1.2 billion and an excess of 30,000 deaths. It's unfortunately called harvesting. Excess deaths beyond what you'd imagine. In terms of a shifting distribution, what are we looking at? By mid-century, that extreme event tends to become your average climate. So that's what the effect of that shifting distribution. That's about what the science has said you should limit warming to. Why, if you go to the end of the century, that extreme event becomes a cold day. So that's the effect of a shifting distribution on the characterisation of those extreme events. And so when these extreme events come along, they're really good learning opportunities as planning tools for the future. Going back to our own recent example of a killer heatwave, back to the events of February 2009 across southern Australia, what you're looking at there is maximum temperature anomalies, and you can see about 6 degrees above the average temperature over a really wide part of Australia in the maximum temperature. That's quite a jump in terms of record-breaking events. And what we've plotted here is basically return periods. So we're looking at how often does this event come around. Prior to the 80s, you're looking at probably greater than a century for those events. If you look at the whole of southern Australia, they were coming around probably, every 10 years or so. In Adelaide, certainly, they got hit with a whole lot at once. So that's, again, this shift in the natural variability, potentially. It's very hard in Australia to work that out, but this is the sort of, and this is a monitoring tool developed at the Bureau to kind of inform this recurrence interval for engineering and other purposes. So that slight shift, what's the impact of it? And again, we're going to look at Black Saturday and the week of the heatwave leading up to that, which was important as well. So we had a week of very dry conditions, prolonged drought, and then we get a 46.4 degree day, 47 degree day, way off the record. Most people are familiar that we had 173 deaths from bushfires, 414 injured. What gets reported less is that whole week led to 374 excess deaths from extreme heat. So that type of thing really does inform planning. In South Australia, they've had a very good public health program around this issue. They go out and check on the mentally ill and the elderly during these events. Their mortality rate was very much reduced compared to Victoria's. So they're the top ambulance call-outs. This kind of data becomes really important. And understanding that natural variability, this recurrence interval, is really important. But that slight shift from going to just, a 42, 43 degree day to having prolonged, very hot conditions makes a massive difference. So now we're going to come back to extreme weather in 2010, 2011, and just talk about what happened. I think I showed this previously, which is the Australian rainfall deciles. Again, what we're looking at is record rainfall in the highest bracket. In terms of spring rainfall over that period, we definitely broke all previous records by some margin, and that's this spike here from almost all states except WA and Tasmania. Heavy precip days or heavy rain days, comparable with the 74 event, but we had this really widespread rainfall anomaly. What happened around the country? So this is the actual rainfall in millimetres. Darwin experienced wettest day, wettest week, wettest month in February with 367 millimetres. That's in one, 367 millimetres in one day. That's, you know, probably more than a third of Canberra and Melbourne's annual rainfall dumped in a 24 to 48 hour period. Tropical cyclone Yasi, of course, similar to the 1918 La Nina, we got a category 5 cyclone crossing the coast. During the La Nina, you tend to get about double the amount of tropical cyclones just because of all that warm ocean waters around Australia. Everyone knows what happened in Brisbane. Heat wave in Sydney, just keeping with that theme of extreme events in 2010 and why this was such a big news event. Victoria, we had flooding October, December, January, February over 2010-11, significant flooding as well, relating to those purple patches on the map. Southwest WA, by contrast, driest year on record and periods of extreme heat. The absolute opposite record setting in Southwest WA, and I will talk about that a little bit more. And we had flooding through Carnarvon in December. I haven't put everything on there just so it doesn't get tedious. We really did have a lot of record-breaking events over 2000, the last 18 months, really. So, part of that's that natural variability, that influence of La Nina, which brings warm ocean temperatures. There's another component of that people are asking, is it related to climate change? The most significant piece of science that goes into that is this hydrological cycle, this evaporation off the oceans and this rainfall. A very consistent result over the last three decades of climate modelling is that you intensify that hydrological cycle the more heat you pump into the oceans. And that intensification means in the tropics you get more intense and heavy rainfall. Counterintuitively to some, in the subtropics and the Mediterranean climate, it means more prolonged droughts, but when it does rain, it rains more intensely. And going right back to that first couple of slides that we had, where we're looking at the frequency of heavy rainfall events in Australia, it's very likely that we're going to change that. So we're probably going to have a longer duration between these periods and heavier rainfall when it does occur. And that is really due to this intensification of the hydrological cycle. So that's driven by this increase in sea surface temperature, which we've observed as well as modelled. So since 1900, temperatures have consistently increased decade after decade. It's very true in the Australian region. So when we're looking at this intense La Nina event, we know it's normally warmer than normal around Australia. What we also found looking at the data was in those records that are in those areas that are orange, we had highest on record sea surface temperatures, not just by a little bit, by a very, very long way, as you can see from that red spike on the graph up there. And regionally, we had, you know, half a degree above the previous maximum on average, and then sometimes 3 degrees above that. Very, very dramatic increases in sea surface temperatures in regions that our models and our seasonal climate outlooks and everything else know are important to Australian rainfall. So yes, there's natural variability. We do believe there's a component from climate change as well. Determining how much that contributed to the rainfall is really difficult. And I think in some ways it's nonsensical. It's a question that gets asked if you just want to have a confused conversation. If you just wanted to have a sensible conversation about, well, what does this mean going forward? It means probably that we've loaded the dice towards these heavy-weighted rainfall events. And that's a good illustration of it. But that's that rainfall. And now, just to close off, I guess I'm going to talk about these long-term trends in rainfall. And in some ways, what's happened in the last 18 months, I think, shouldn't distract us from the long-term trends in rainfall. And it would be remiss of us not to communicate that at this point in time. I've prepared a lot of Senate estimates and ministerial advice on these, putting it in. It's a confusing message. People don't really get it. I think if it's raining outside, they don't want to be talking about drought or rainfall reduction. But it's precisely the time to talk about that in some ways, given what's going forward. So what are we talking about? We're talking about in WA since the mid-70s, so greater than 30 years, and in southeastern Australia since about 1996, about a 10 to 20% reduction in that wintertime rainfall. So the rainfall that comes from those mid-latitude winter systems is less than it used to be. There's drought in southeast Queensland. It's not that statistically significant in terms of that natural variability. It's this reduction across the south that's been so important. And you can see it here in southeastern Australia, just that absence of wet years and a reduction in the rainfall. It's a step change. And in southwest WA, it's been even more dramatic. And you can sort of see in the early part of that record, southwest WA probably had the most reliable wintertime rainfall in the whole country. You just have to go look at the Karri Forest and other things to look at how much it used to rain out there. When you go out there now, as I have for field work, you go down into the limestone caves, you can see the high water mark above your head, but you can pick up dust off the bottom of the cave floor. The forest is in distress. There's a lot of indicators now showing that drought, that rainfall reduction is pretty much locked in. So we're talking in these two regions here, what weather systems are we talking about? We're talking about these cold fronts and storms that come through in winter over that region. So that includes the Canberra and southern New South Wales region as well. And again, Perth's a little bit further north than us, so if we had an expansion of the tropics pushing these storm systems away, we'd expect it to happen in Perth first. That's what we have observed by about 15 years. We're going to keep watching this for the next 20 or 30 years. And the big thing to note about the rainfall that we had over the last 10 months or so is it did not occur in autumn and winter. We don't really have a good cause to say that we're out of this dry deficit at this point. The rainfall was all in spring and summer. It was tropical rainfall that's pushed down from the north. It wasn't wintertime rainfall from these systems. And these are the ones that we're most concerned about. So they're the ones that we want to keep communicating. We think there's a long-term shift in these. And the shift in that is due to pressure changes. There's this big thing called the subtropical ridge, which most people know as those high-pressure systems that circle around Australia. If we count those, there's a dramatic trend in the density of those over southern Australia. And that's attenuating the influence of El Niño and that natural variability. So that's what we're really looking at. And it's consistent with our greenhouse modelling, that change. So that's really the concern that we've got there. And it's consistent with projections of the future as well. These brown areas are where all the climate models around the world generally agree it's going to be drier in the future. And you can see the regions, that corner of southwest WA is one of them. So there's a lot of consistency in the science going into this now. And what's the impact of that, just to finish off? The impact of losing the autumn and winter rainfall has a massive effect on stream flow, because what that generally does is precondition, it primes the catchments for rainfall further in winter. If you don't do that, the rainfalls in winter just get soaked up by the soil and vegetation. So generally what we've found is 10 to 20% reduction in autumn and winter rainfall leads to about a 60% reduction in subsequent stream flow throughout the year. Victoria still had lower than average stream flow in 2010. Even despite the rainfall, the inflows into the dams were still below the long-term average. It's quite a concern. You can see the Murray-Darling Basin system, that systematic step change during the drought, where we have that long-term average in stream flows, 1,600 gigalitres. By 2008-09, we were really flatlining almost. To look at that in Perth storage system, where this is much more dramatic, we can see this consistent step down in the amount of water getting into Perth storage, to the point that they got zero inflows in 2010. So they got nothing into their dams, which is really driving the policy response of building desal plants around that region. Don't know if that's the right thing to do or not. But really, again, we're talking about the impact of this rainfall reduction on long-term water storages and water resources. And the other thing about prolonged drought is its impact on fire weather in the medium term. I say medium term here, if you long-term change a fire regime, you change the vegetation, so things change beyond what we can predict. But certainly, the duration of drought, the addition of heat, adds to the fire danger. And we saw that in Canberra, we've seen that across southeastern Australia. It removes natural fire breaks, soaks and things in the environment. And if you talk to the fireys, it was certainly a different nature of the fire that they've seen. Even looking at satellite records, the pictures of the fires are a little bit different. Don't need to go into that too much. But again, just a couple of the impacts of this prolonged drought and the impacts of going forward, if we're going to look at that change in the natural variability, this slight shift going forward. Now, I think I'll probably end it there and take questions. Am I chairing Chris? Sorry.
Thanks, Carl. On one of your earlier slides, when you were showing driest on record for a period back in the Federation droughts or whatever, did that mean driest on the record up until that time, or driest
over the whole sample? Yeah, so yeah, it was very dry during the Federation drought. The depth of the drought in autumn is probably the thing that's differentiated the current drying period. Again, that's a little bit worrying. And the pressure signal. It really was pressure driven rather than probably El Nino or La Nina driven. That's still a scientific research question though. Rainfall is difficult to determine, but there's circumstantial evidence around these, I think. Yeah.
There was a pre-settlement drought. There was a big drought in 17th century, I think, like it was reported the reef where there was a 60-year drought. Where the reports the Burdekin didn't flow, and whatever. If you had a huge length of the drought where it was extraordinarily dry, are we just in the middle of an event like that?
In terms of rainfall?
That's right.
60-year drought isn't really as far as we're concerned. If you've got a 60-year drought, that's not a drought. That's just part of the normal climate of that region, and it probably swings around. When we're talking about droughts, these are through sort of more tightly defined rainfall deficits. Right. So that's meteorological drought.
Okay.
Hydrological drought is different again. That's the stream flow, and there's a difference. So the rainfall deficits expressed differently to the hydrological drought. There, I was discussing earlier, there's paleo evidence from Australia, Lake George, from the tree ring records. There's certainly wet periods in the 1800s. It looks like the 19th century has been drier. But in terms of where we sit in that cycle, I think it's difficult to determine statistically, obviously. Our best tool for that is looking at the climate modelling and looking at the paleo evidence. I don't think we could say that there is these big century scale shifts in Australian rainfall on the evidence that we've got before us now. Really what we're better off looking at is the mechanisms that cause drought, trying to differentiate what's caused it and see if we can just determine what differences each of these droughts have had and can we determine cause and effect from that. Yeah, I'm not sure that's totally answered your question, But rainfall's tricky because the distribution for rainfall doesn't look normal. It's not like it is for temperature. It's, you know, you'll have a whole lot clustered around zero and then it sort of tails off. To do a shift in the rainfall distribution for Australia is harder to measure. And looking at climate models, you know, if you asked a climate scientist, what do you least want to talk about in terms of the future, it'd be rainfall, tropical cyclones. What do you most want to talk about? It'd be temperature. But the rainfall is a self-selecting question. And regionally, it's a self-selecting question too. They want to know what happened in southwest WA particularly. That's where you start to need a lot of supercomputing power to answer that question. And it's a difficult question to answer. There's an uncertainty cascade there, and I guess the way the science operates is entirely different to the way the policy operates. The science is probably the most certain part of the science. Just says what happens to the total climate system if you double atmospheric CO2. So you double atmospheric CO2, you're going to dramatically shift the climate system. Unfortunately, that's the hardest thing to form policy on. You need global agreements, you need a whole lot of other stuff. The easiest thing to get action on is adaptation. What's going to happen regionally? What can I do regionally? That's built on the most uncertain part of the science, but that's where the motivation and the social system goes into to informing policy better. An analogy for that would be something like skin cancer. So the fundamental science says if you have early exposure to UV radiation, you are really predisposed to getting a skin cancer later in life. So you know how to act on that. The analogy is if you then said, well, tell me what age I'm going to get that skin cancer and where it's going to occur in my body, and I'm going to use that information to manage the risk rather than the other information. And if you can't tell me that information, I'm just going to take no action at all. I'm going to assume the whole thing's wrong. And to take that approach in medicine is ridiculous. But to take it in this context is easier because we're talking about the future. People practice future discounting all the time. To actually have that the wrong way around, to what the science is informing, that's just the way it has been, I think.
What does science tell us about the factors that cause long-term climate change or long-term weather change, apart from increased CO2 that is possibly contributed to by the Industrial Revolution, basically.
You mean natural factors? So external forcing factors, the main things that force a climate system are changes in solar radiation, changes in atmospheric chemistry. So changes in atmospheric chemistry can be increases in volcanic ash through volcanic activity, and a range of other changes over the geological record. When you look through the paleoclimate geological evidence, the type of rapid changes we're seeing now in atmospheric chemistry, CO2 and others, the only analogue for those are really large impact asteroids, where you actually take a 200-year period to double atmospheric CO2. The only time that happens is really through these dramatic events. Otherwise, it takes a long, long time to happen. So if you talk about an ice age, the external forcing factor there is this tilt in the Earth's axis as it goes around the sun. Those changes are typically about 100 times slower than what we've seen over the last century. So when people talk about humans experiencing past climate change, probably no single generation was aware it was going on. It took many multiple generations, to go into and out of an ice age. You would have long migrated moving with the weather in that time. The idea that we should feel climate change and that's the only time we should be concerned about it is, again, a really balmy idea as far as the science goes. If you're feeling rapid climate change, that's a really, really alarming thing from the geological history. So the models over the 20th century and are forced with solar radiation, volcanoes, sulfate aerosols, pollutants such as dust particles, ozone changes, a range of other things. And what we do with those models is to look for fingerprints of what they do. So not just global mean temperature, we look for what we call optimised spatial fingerprints. So they're three-dimensional patterns of what each of those forcing factors does to the atmosphere. The unfortunate thing is the only one that matches that three-dimensional fingerprint is greenhouse gas increases. So that's really what's informed the science and the concern in the science. And you know that CO2 is isotopically tagged to fossil fuels. It's not that we're just assuming that it's from fossil fuel production. You can actually look at the isotopic structure. You can tell where it's come from. So that's really what the underlying external factor. That's why we believe so strongly that it's a problem.
But Maya supplemented.
Yeah, definitely.
Has there been a period, and what was the natural cause of a depletion in the ozone layer?
I'm not an ozone expert. I'm almost certain that you would get changes in ozone naturally. So ozone is actually related to how much oxygen there is in the atmosphere, and oxygen is a very volatile gas. The Earth's atmosphere is actually really volatile. Most planets you probably couldn't strike a match and it just lights up, unless it's got a volatile constituent in the atmosphere, and that's oxygen. That oxygen turns into O3 further above. So changes in solar radiation, changes in cosmic radiation and things will cause ozone changes. In recent history, I'm not sure about stratospheric ozone depletion. The stratospheric ozone depletion that we observed recently was really closely tagged to the effect of polar stratospheric clouds and CFCs, chlorofluorocarbons. That was much more deterministic than even greenhouse climate science. You could do that in a lab, basically. Yeah, but past ozone changes, no, you probably have to talk to an ozone expert on that. Yeah, the stratospheric sort of person.
It would be hard to know because they haven't been monitored.
We don't have many records of that. Yeah, so you'd have to sort of reconstruct it from what was happening at lower levels.
Yeah.
But in terms of the paleo record, there's probably little that we understand about ozone. And you know, the total ozone, people get the wrong idea about that too. They think the ozone's depleted, therefore there's more skin cancer in Australia. That ozone hole was just tightly constrained over Antarctica. The amount that bleeds into the rest of the atmosphere was, you know, just less than 2% probably. It's more that if we allowed that process to continue, it would have resulted in changes to the atmospheric system again. The reductions in stratospheric ozone probably have part responsibility for what's happened over southern Australia as well. There's this thing called a southern annual node, which is the way these storm systems move north and south. And the influence of the loss of stratospheric ozone is probably also felt in that rainfall decline. The hope is that you'll get some partial recovery potentially as the ozone recovers in that rainfall. Very difficult to determine that, again, because it's rainfall. It's very, very hard to work out.
Finally, is there a printout of your slide presentation?
There will be, yes.
And we'll put it on the website of the Vital Issues.
Because
this raises a lot of very complex issues in terms of agriculture and which could potentially have a different effect.
And I guess I hope I've sort of demonstrated how the two things are intertwined. It's very hard to have a conversation just about Australian variability, particularly to policymakers and planners, without talking about the impact of climate change as well. And, you know, again, it's a diabolical policy outcome because the best practice response is really expensive to manage that total variability. So if you were to manage a water resource for all the wet years and all the dry years forever, it's a major engineering feat that we don't put the money into. You can re-engineer a bridge for return periods quite easily, or even a dam to just do the maximum amount. But most of our systems require this single timeline going into the future rather than a spread of results. That's how we've built our planning systems. So that's really confounding. It's as a scientist looking in, I've been involved in day-long planning meetings with water resource managers, energy companies. I don't envy their task at all in trying to come up with an optimised solution to these problems given the constraints that we work under.
Carl, can you tell us where the Bureau's up to with its efforts on better predictive capacity? What you might call short to medium.
Seasonal
stuff from 12 months out and that sort of thing.
Yeah, 12 months.
That's sort of, I think, links to what people want to adapt to. They want that information to be able to have an adaptive response.
So there's different timescales. So obviously the weather now, I think there'll be moderate improvements in weather forecasting as we go forward. As a physical problem, the supercomputing and everything is probably doing almost as good a job as we can do on the weather forecast. That's a deterministic forecast telling you exactly what is going to happen. Once you go beyond that scale, it becomes a probabilistic forecast. So for the seasonal climate outlook, currently it's statistical. So we look at statistical analogues of sea surface temperature patterns, and from those we look at, okay, how much did it rain? We found that doesn't work anymore because of this shifting climate in the Pacific and the Indian Ocean. The Indian Ocean's always in one mode now. It's because it's warmed up so much. So we've got a dynamical model, which is a climate model that's run in seasonal forecast mode. We've got beta products out from that. Before you release it as an operational product, obviously, there's a lot of further testing and development that has to be done. We're hopeful to get that out in the next few years. Having said that, they were hopeful 10 years ago of getting that out. But I think we are close to having a dynamical product. An intra-seasonal product is one that is a couple of weeks, and that's actually the more useful one to irrigators and farmers. If you tell them what's going to happen in a few seasons hence, it's not a lot of decisions that you base on that. You've probably already got the crop in the ground in some ways, but how much nitrogen you add and a whole range of other things is informed by this intra-seasonal timescale. And that's the one that we're really trying to focus on. Beyond that scale is really hard. There's just too much chaos and unpredictability in the system. There's a decadal prediction project around the world now to see if we can do these mean decadal shifts based on really large changes in the oceans. It's very experimental. And one volcano goes off, it's going to change that prediction. So as a scientist, you're in two minds about it. It's like, okay, this is what you want, this is what we're going to give you, but at the same time, are we going to be hung on this being wrong, or are people going to confuse it as a planning and predictive tool? Probably highly likely. And particularly with the seasonal forecast, we want to put it on a map. People just go to their town and look at what's going to happen there. They don't look at the broader area or what's happening in eastern Australia. And as you saw from those rainfall maps, you really should look at the broad area. A La Nina means rainfall, but not at your farm necessarily, or not at your port. It's somewhere in eastern Australia. So there's an amazing amount of planning decisions. You know, how much water you move from a tailings dam before the monsoon season, things like that. Again, a best practice response is expensive. So that's where we're focused on there. And dynamic models. The international community will probably have multi-model ensembles for this at some time in the future, and even for weather. I think you're probably going to have these big computing resources around the world pooled into one area is probably the way it's developing.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much, Carl. It's amazingly complex, and it is so different to look at the issue of rain rather than just temperature, because we've probably focused on that in the past. But it's just been fabulous to have you give us such a range of information. The audio will be up later this afternoon. The slides will be up as soon as we possibly can, which will be a day or two. But it's been fabulous. Thank you so much for your insights today. Thank you, everyone, for attending.
It's a traditional Chinese.
What is it?
So six harmonies.
Oh, okay.
Boxing.
I do Shaolin.
Part of the Shaolin.
Yeah, cool. Yeah.
How did you know that?
Because I used to be a doctor.
Okay, right.
I'm what you call a geek.
Yeah.
The reason I was asking about the drug, basically, the conference in Melbourne, we talked about these extreme events are really big ones where there's, I got a call four or 5 years ago about, there's a claim that the Burdekin didn't flow for 60 years.
Yeah, sure.
Whether it did or not, I mean, another question. But the evidence from the brain coral rings, saying basically it was,
I think
virtually nothing coming out. I don't know.
The possibility for shifts in Australian rainfall, so it's not really drought, but shifts is certainly.
But he was basically saying what we're talking about is not is the fact that these we don't know. We're always talking about the 90% or whatever.
Right,
we don't know what the extremes are. We don't know what the end of
lunch.
That's right.
And that's the thing. He says it could be down to there. We don't know what the range is.
Anyway,
so we're making the decisions. This is for an engineering point of view.
Yeah, sure.
We're making the decisions on this. We can't make
that. And again, that comes back to that. Your best practice is very expensive in that regard.
I mean, of course, I'll just talk about that best practice.
Thanks, Leo.